not read the bulletin article in front, take 2 minutes to read it right now. And while you're reading it, let me make an announcement, and somebody might have an update on this, I don't know. We just got a phone call a few just before our early assembly that Gina Talbot, who had surgery on the back of her neck, Gina fell down the stairs this morning, all the way from the top to the bottom. So all we know is that she was going to teach a class, and her mother called to tell her co-teacher that she was not going to be here. So that's all I know. I don't know if they took her to the doctor or didn't. I don't know. But it's never a good thing to fall down the stairs, but it's certainly not a good thing to fall down the stairs after you've had an neck surgery. So let's keep Gina Talbot and that family in our prayers. Okay, we're in Romans chapter 9, and y'all can be praying, some of you, while we go through this section here, because I'll need it. If you've read the bulletin article, you'll at least have some of my feelings about Romans chapter 9, 10, and 11, the whole, actually three chapters, but 9 is going to introduce it, set the stage for 9, 10, and 11. And, you know, I don't know how much time, how long have... Cleo, how long have we been, this class been going? Is this 9 months or 12? I don't remember.
9 months.
9. Okay, well, if I had a year, I might get through Romans. I don't know. Probably not. But anyway, I've enjoyed it up to this point. And,
a gentleman who will remain anonymous said, well, he's averaging chapter per month.
Chapter a month. Well, that's pretty good for me. Yeah, you ought to be in my Bible survey Thursday morning class. Romans 9. There is a divine principle involved in this section which is difficult for, and I'll say me, I want to say us, but that's up to you, to not necessarily understand, but to accept. I think we can, on the surface, understand it, but the acceptance of it is the hard part. Because there are some things here we're not used to in the United States of America. We're not used to sovereignty. We don't like it too much. We like, for instance, our government to be answerable to the people. And they may not be, but if they're not, we're upset about that. And so if we're not really careful, we'll transfer that same idea to God, that we think really deep in our heart of hearts that what God does has to make sense to me and it has to satisfy my sense of justice and so forth. And we, having varying degrees of fear of the Lord, may or may not overtly say, I don't like God, or I don't like this. We may not say that. Sometimes we have to struggle with some of the things that God did, because, quite frankly, we don't necessarily like it. And I want to go back and set the theme a little bit for this section. You remember the theme of this epistle is in Romans chapter 1, verse 16 and 17. And occasionally you need to go back when you're studying, and I'm saying me. I tend to get involved in words and thoughts and details and try to see how this fits and this fits and this fits. And sometimes I tend to forget what the whole picture is. And so quite often as I'm studying, I will, if I know the theme of what I'm studying, the overarching principle, I will write that in the margin of where I'm taking my notes so that I'll occasionally glance up there and see, okay, this is what the whole purpose of this is. And somehow this fits into that whole overall purpose. And the purpose of this epistle is the proclamation that the gospel is God's power for salvation to everyone who believes, for the Jew first and then the Gentile. The gospel was not exclusively for the Jew. that speaks directly to this section right here, chapters 9 through 11. He's laid the groundwork for this section in chapter 2, verse 8 and 9. He says, a man is not a Jew if he's one only one outwardly, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a man is a Jew if he's one inwardly, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart by the Spirit and not by the written code. We've been there, so we're not going to go back and camp there. But just to show that he early on introduced this concept that he's going to pursue in great detail now. And the concept here is, again, that the gospel is not exclusively for the Jew. And besides that, who is the true Jew? If you use Jew in the sense of not a race, but those people who are God's called people. And so he says, a Jew is not just somebody who's circumcised and keeps the law, but it's someone who is one inwardly, and his circumcision is circumcision of the heart. So he's already introduced this thought. So it's not brand new. And he also has said that true righteousness doesn't come from law. It comes from God by faith apart from law. And we, you know, as much as I have within me, have tried to emphasize that is the message that we need to understand and that you need to understand. And it's hard for us, those of us who grew up in the church, it's hard for some of us to accept that. And if that's true, I can promise you it was 10 times harder for the Jew to accept that. Because he never had ever questioned. As Christians, we have at least had some reason to question law righteousness. And even if we didn't completely understand it, at least we had been taught and we have a principle that is not, you know, righteousness is not a matter of works, but it's a matter of faith. At least we had that principle that was put in us somewhere along the line, whether we knew what to do with it or whether we didn't. But the Jew didn't have that. His righteousness was from law. And then in chapter 3, verse 29, is God the God of the Jews only? Is he not the God of the Gentiles too? Yes, of the Gentiles too, since there is only one God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through that same faith. And so all along he's been planting seeds for what this section is going to address. You see, the Christian Jews were having difficulty. Number one, accepting Jesus Christ as the Messiah and imputed righteousness. And let me say, and I ended last time talking about, you know, if you were accustomed to being the star on the sports team and, you know, some new kids came in your school and all of a sudden somebody took your place. They bumped you out of your place as quarterback and you've been playing that since you were in the sixth grade. And for the last 5 years, you've been the quarterback on the team or you whatever position, and then somebody comes along and they become the starter. How do you do sitting on the pine? How do you do sitting on the bench and watching somebody else play? Does that arouse jealousy? Does that arouse anger in you? Does that arouse hostility in you? Does it make you want to quit? Well, see, all of these things, multiplied many times over, were what the Jew was dealing with and what he's struggling with. And it's hard for us to appreciate that because we're Gentiles. And we're the recipients of this, and it's hard for us to put ourselves in the position of the one who's been God's favorite child all this time, and he's been the starter on God's team all this time, and now, you know, somebody comes in, and he's having to sit the pine some. And it's hard. And the Jews are having trouble, obviously, accepting Jesus as the Messiah, because he didn't fit their M.O. of who their Messiah was going to be. The Christian Jews are having trouble with imputed righteousness because they've been born and bred with law righteousness. Accepting the Gentiles as equals in Christ is a real struggle because that's never been a part of their thinking. And so now, I mean, the Gentiles have been dirty dogs. And now to sit beside a family that's Gentile, this is a real problem here. Because it's not just a matter of racial prejudice, it's a matter of spiritual prejudice also. So you just multiply all those things. And it's really, really difficult for them to conceive of the idea that a Gentile is equal to a Jew in God's eyes. That's hard for them. And then, on top of all this, the Gentiles had no basis to understand what this fuss is all about. Why should you have to go into all this stuff? Isn't it obvious that I'm as good as you are? And so, if there are some Gentiles who have bought into the concept that they're not as good as the Jews, then they're going to have trouble on, you know, feeling like that they're really a part of this thing, because Jesus was a Jew, after all. He was one of them, wasn't he? And so you bring all these things into the church, and they're really having to struggle. There are lots of struggles. And, you know, I don't want, and I don't think it's really fair to make a parallel. Some of you can have some, relate to this in some ways, of racial prejudice. That there in the church, there's been a problem with that historically. And, you know, of course, I'm not going to get into that, but I'm just saying some of us who grew up in the Deep South, you know, we have roots in some of this. And by the way, it goes both directions, okay? I'm not just pointing to one race. It goes both directions. So they had all of these problems that they bring, that we bring to chapter 9. In chapter 9, if you want to put a theme to it, the righteousness of faith is not against the promises of God. That's what chapter 9 is about. The righteousness of faith, the fact that righteousness comes through faith, is not against the promises of God. That's the problem that is being dealt with here. And let me see if I can give you the spiritual dilemma that these people are experiencing. Let me ask you this question. To whom did God give the promises?
Abraham.
To Abraham and his seed. To Israel. Right? Look at chapter 9, verse 4. He's talking about to Paul, and we haven't gotten into that text yet, but he's going to be talking about the Jews as a nation. He says, to theirs is the adoption of son, theirs the divine glory, the covenants, the receiving of the law, the temple worship, and the promise. So God gave the promises to Israel. But now he has cast off Israel. He has rejected Israel. And we're going to see those terms used in the next couple of chapters. And that teaching is coming to them. And they don't understand how this could be possible. This doesn't fit in with their theology at all, their Jewish theology. Now, next question. Why has he cast them off? Because of their unfaithfulness? Yes or no? Because of their unfaithfulness? Is that why he cast them off? Yes. Now, let me show you a problem. Turn to chapter 3. Hold your finger there at 9, because we're going to come back there in a second. Turn to chapter 3, verse 3 and 4. What if some did not have faith? Will their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness? That's the problem. Because we've already established here, how does he answer that? Not at all. No. It doesn't mean that God's going to be unfaithful. Let God be true, every man be a liar. Now, here's the problem. Israel's faithfulness does not nullify, or Israel's faithlessness does not nullify God's faithfulness. Right? We've already established that. But don't the facts now refute this claim? Why did God cast them off? Because of their unfaithfulness, right? But we we've already set up, that their faithlessness, their lack of faith, does not mean that God's going to be faithless. He's not going to live up to his promises. Well, we got a problem here. Wait, just a second.
Didn't he do that a lot to try and get them to come back?
He's going to get that in chapter 11. Yes, it's going to be the reason. But they don't know that. We don't know that yet because we hadn't read that far. We hadn't studied that far yet. So we don't know that yet.
God's faithfulness wasn't nullified because part of his promise was that if they weren't faithful, they would be cast aside and punished. So God still remained faithful even though they were unrighteous and he selected a new.
And you and I understand that. They didn't understand that. They didn't understand that. They said, what's happening here and all this happening in the church means that God has not lived up to the promises he gave to our father Abraham and to us as a nation. That's the problem that they were with.
But do they see themselves as unfaithful?
No.
So that's the problem.
No. Very few people ever do. We don't see, even when we are, we don't see ourselves that way.
Right.
Do we? We justify it so that it's not real. Yes.
Isn't the issue that they did not accept Jesus as the Messiah? Because all their prophecies said Messiah would come. And so by them denying the presentation of Jesus as the Messiah, they've essentially written off God's plan for them.
Yeah. And that would be the case in the Jews who are not Christians. But here in Romans 9, this is addressed to Christians. And the real problem that he's addressing here is in the church. It's people who are Jews who have become Christians who are really having a struggle with it. Really, the problem is, can he let the Gentiles in as equals? That's the problem that we're dealing with. And we tend to not, on the surface, relate to that very well. But it really does apply to us. It really does. Because either on an individual basis, there are some people. Somebody came to me this after class last week and said, you know, I have a problem with Jeffrey Dahmer. Remember who he is? Yeah, he's the guy that killed people and then ate body parts and they found, you know, in his refrigerator, they found human body parts and this kind of thing. And then he went in prison and before he died, Church of Christ preacher contacted him, and he was baptized and became a Christian. You remember that? Did you have any feelings about that when that happened? Yeah, you had some feelings about it. You may or may not admit them, and I'm not saying what they were, but I'm saying you had some feelings about it. It's hard upon initially hearing that to assume the best, that he became a Christian just not long before he died. It's hard to assume that because we didn't have any great love for him. Right? And for us to accept, okay, God forgave him and he has as much reward as I do, who've been a Christian all my life, you know, trying to serve the Lord, then this is hard for me to get my mind around. It's hard for me to let God do that. You with me? Somebody that was, his crime was as atrocious as this guy's crime was, in our minds, he doesn't deserve this. You know, what does he deserve? He deserves to burn in hell forever and ever and ever. Okay? I'll say it for you. You know what you deserve? And what I deserve? But that's hard for me. You know, it takes a while to come to that, to be able to say that. You hear me? You can't say that just when it first occurs to you. You got to get. It takes time for your mind to get around that so that you can say that.
This isn't just history. There are people. The movement I recall started in the 80s, where there were Jews for Jesus. We lived in Connecticut, so we heard a lot because there are a lot of Jewish people that live up in that area, and they struggled with what to give
the Jewish issue is not as much our problem, but the principles are still our problem. Blaine? And that's exactly right, and it takes a while to get there. Okay? We don't start out there as a Christian. And particularly those of us who grew up in a religious environment, it's really hard for us to get there. So our conclusion at this point is that, or at least that the people we're making and struggling with, the gospel, which teaches righteousness by grace through faith apart from law, does it conflict with the promises that God gave to Israel? Now, let me tell you what's at stake here for Paul. It's not, I mean, he spends three chapters on this. Now, he didn't originally write it in chapters, but it's been broken down into chapters since he wrote it. But a big section here that he spent on this. And lots of folks feel like, well, this, you can just set this aside. And this is not really that vital for us. But what's at stake? Well, here's what's at stake. Either the gospel is not being presented properly, which would be what the Jews and maybe some of the Jewish Christians regarding the Gentiles would say. Those in Jerusalem, they came to Antioch. You remember? In Acts? And what did they say? Hey, you got to add a little law to this grace in order to be saved. These Gentiles, they can be saved, but they're going to have to come under the law in order to be saved. And so don't tell me they weren't struggling with law. They were struggling with law. And don't tell me that we don't struggle with law. We struggle with law. And so either the gospel is not being presented accurately, which would be what the position that many would take, or God is not righteous. One of those two things. With the way that Paul and the early preachers at that time in this frontier church, the way they were presenting this, then as they sat down in their Jewish study groups or their Gentile study groups and they considered all of this, then they would say, okay, either this gospel that Paul is preaching is not right, and there were many, many Christians who believed that, right? They were the Judaizers. They pursued him from place to place to place to place. And they tried to undermine what he taught. And so that was one of the things. Or on the other hand, if what he's saying is true, then God's not really righteous. God hasn't been truthful. He hasn't been faithful to what he's told Israel is going to happen. There's the dilemma here. And so Paul's task is to show that the gospel does not conflict with God's promise. Now, if you want it in a nutshell, that's a nutshell of what 9, 10, and 11 is about. It is Paul's task to demonstrate that the gospel does not conflict with the promises that God has given. So, with that in mind, verses 1 through 3. I speak the truth in Christ. I'm not lying. My conscience confirms it in the Holy Spirit. For I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart, for I could wish that I myself were cursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brother, those of my own race. Now, why would he say that? Well, he would say that because as the apostle to the Gentiles, the Jews would very easily feel about him, he doesn't care about us. He's holding up the Gentile side. He doesn't really relate to us. He's a traitor to us. And so Paul wants to make sure that people understand that even though he is and has been prepared as the the apostle to the Gentiles, he doesn't approach this with cool detachment. Do you remember anybody that a long time before he said that said something really similar to that? Anybody remember another leader of God's people? Moses. God told Moses on one occasion, put some distance between you and these people because I'm fixing to wipe them off the face of the earth. And Moses immediately said to God, forgive their sin, and if not, blot me, I pray you, out of your book. You think Paul knew that he had said that? Moses said that. Now, when you say that, if you genuinely mean that, what did you just do? You showed your involvement, your closeness to your people, right? If they thought you had forgotten them and abandoned them and been a traitor and were holding up the other side of this thing, then either they're going to call you a liar and say he doesn't really mean that, or if he really means that, then he really does love us. He really does relate to us. Okay, so he starts out this, and do you see the need to do that? Because if you're mad, and you're saying all this stuff that Paul is saying is not true, or either God is not righteous, then you're going to start throwing everything you can on the fire to justify your feelings. And one of the things that they would throw on the fire is Paul doesn't care. He's not a Jew anymore. He's been around those Gentiles for so long that he has more sympathy for them than he does us. He's not one of us anymore. And so Paul will say, he made the statement. Then he said, I'm not lying. And I call the Holy Spirit as a witness to that fact. So he's laying it as hard as he can, and as truthfully as he can be, for I could wish that I myself were cursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, my own race. Wow. Can you say that? That's tough. You could probably say that about your own personal family, couldn't you? If that was a choice that had to be made, I could say that. I wouldn't want to say that. I could say that. If it meant my children and my grandchildren, I could say that. If that was a choice, couldn't you? Realizing.
You're not making it absolute. You said I could wish.
That's right. That's right. And it's hypothetical. Yeah. But he said it in such a way as to let them know how deeply he loves them and how much he cares about them. So. And then verse 4 and 5, he says, the people of Israel. Theirs, and he starts this list, theirs is the adoption as sons. Theirs the divine glory, the covenants, the receiving of the law, the temple worship, the promises. For theirs are the patriarchs, and for them is traced according Christ, according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit, God over all. Now, I just gave you a more literal translation than what you probably have. Over all, praise forever. Amen. Why does he give this, set forth this list of advantages that the Jews have had? Well, let me tell you why I think he does. Because I think he wants them to know how completely he identifies with them. Do you think he said anything here that they didn't know? No, they knew that. He wants them to know that he knows that and that he still remembers that. They have been God's favorite child, have they not? For generation after generation after generation after generation. They have been the starter on God's team. They've been his favorite child. They've been the child with the coat of many colors, haven't they? And they've become accustomed to that. And with all of that in mind, he wants them to know that he understands how inconceivable it is that God has rejected Israel. That's why he put that in there. So that they know that he knows what they're struggling with. I mean, how could God, when he's done this and 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 this for me all of these years, how could he turn his back on me? You see, he's letting them know, I understand your struggle. I identify with what you're saying. And all of these things are true. Yes, ma'am.
Stephen says that he is a kinsman of theirs.
That's right. He is. He's blood kin, isn't he? That's exactly right. And all of these things, they have been the one that God has shown favoritism to. Has he not? He has. Well, how can you turn your back on somebody that's been your favorite all this time? You see the struggle? And Paul's letting them know that he understands this struggle. Now, we don't have time to go through every one of these things, privileges that God has blessed them with. Does anybody have any question about any one of them? Every one of them is important. And when he comes down to saying, your blood, your ancestry, Christ came from you, from us. He came from the Jews. He was a Jew. And so as according to the flesh, Christ belongs to you. Well, why would he put the Gentiles in this picture here? They don't belong in this picture. It's us. God promised this way back there, and he's just fulfilling his promises, and now you come in here and you say you can drag these Gentiles in here and let them have all the blessings that God has promised. I'm saying they don't belong in this picture. And so they're really struggling with this. Now, I want to make a little note right here also. And I thought about this because when we get on into chapter 10 and 11, you have some points that he really presses that I struggle with. Okay? At this point, I'm going to make this observation. The election, we haven't got there yet, but he's going to be talking about the rejection and the election. The election that he's going to be talking about that God made, he elected certain ones. Under consideration here, at this point, I'm going to maintain, is not salvation, but it is function or purpose. And so when we talk about the people that God elected and God hardened, vessels of mercy and vessels of wrath, I'm going to maintain that this election that he's talking about is not talking about whether or not they're saved, but it's talking about the purpose for which they were elected and designed by God to perform. You have a comment? Somebody? Okay. The question in verse 6. It is not as though God's word has failed. Well, what's that about? Well, here's why. Here's what that statement's about. For not all who are descended from Israel are Israel. That second statement gives you information about why he would make the first statement. And the second statement tells you what the struggle is. The struggle is, who is Israel? Is Israel Abraham's descendants? Well, that would be the natural inclination to say, right? But he's going to show that not all of Abraham's descendants are considered children of the promise. They're not all considered, even by you, be in God's family. And so, verse 6 through 29, his point right here is God's promises belong to believers. You hear me? That's his point in verse 6 through 29. The promises that God made belong to believers, those who have faith. In verse 6 through 9, he says God's election does not depend on human heritage. Watch it. It's not as though God's word had failed, for not all who are descended from Israel are Israel, nor because they are his descendants, Abraham's, are they all Abraham's children. On the contrary, here's something that you know yourself. Through Isaac, underline, shall your offspring come. In other words, it's not the natural children who are God's children, but it's the children of promise who are regarded as Abraham's offspring. Now, you can underline that phrase, children of promise, because that's what he's going to be focusing in on here on. For this was how the promise was stated. Here's the promise. At the appointed time I will return and Sarah will have a son. Now, did Sarah have a son?
Yes.
Did Sarah have two sons? She did, didn't she? But one of them was not the children of the promise. Right? They themselves knew that, right? And so not all of Abraham's seed are Israel. Is that right? That's right. Now, how did God make that choice? Did he make that choice because Isaac was such a wonderful child? Isaac hadn't even been born. God had made a choice. He had made a choice between two. Now here's where the rub starts coming in, folks, for us. Because we start bringing our sense of justice and fairness and so forth into play in this. And sometimes what God does grates against that. Ishmael was not the child of promise. He was not the chosen one. Right? So now he's saying he's laying the groundwork to say, there are two Israels. One physical and one spiritual. One of blood, one of promise. There are two Israels. God's election does not depend on human heritage. Number two, verse 10 through 13. God's election does not depend on, and we can hang in with the first, that one doesn't bother us. God's election does not depend on human merit. It's the second, beginning in verse 10. Not only that, but Rebekah's children had one and the same father, our ancestor Isaac. So he steps it down. Now we've gone from Abraham's children to Isaac's children. Not only did God make a selection and an election in Abraham's children's case, but guess what he's going to do? He's going to make another one that you're aware of. Before the twins were born or had done anything good or bad, in order that God's purpose and election might stand, not by works, but by him who calls, she was told the older will serve the younger. Why?
That was God's plan.
Because God said so. Now, when you were a kid and you came to your parents because your sister or your brother got something that you didn't get and you were jealous and you didn't like the fact they got it or they got to go somewhere and they got to do something that you didn't get to and you started questioning, why does so-and-so get to do that and I don't get to? And you kept pressing that and pressing that, and finally your mother or your dad said what? Because I said so. Now, did you like that? Did that satisfy? Well, the only way you were going to be satisfied with that is if you knew that soon that was going to be followed up with a little more action if you didn't hush. That doesn't satisfy us very well, does it? When we're the one that feels like that we're being slighted. So he says, the older will serve the younger, just as it is written, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated, had less regard for. And then he's going to ask the question, what shall I say? What shall we say is God and just? And so I ask you the question. When you are presented with that situation, God chose one, the younger. The older is going to serve the younger before either one of them is ever born. Is that fair?
Isn't it based on his foreknowledge, though? Could we see through time what character these boys would have, and therefore he chose the one that would turn out to have the best character?
Very possibly, but I will add to that that God consistently chose the younger. He consistently did that, and so I think that there is a principle that's involved here that goes deeper than just any one choice he made, because you see time after time after time after time, the one that humanly speaking should have been the one that was the favorite one, God chose the other.
Like Moses, David.
Yeah, just almost consistently through the whole Old Testament. Well, and I would say this, that allows us to make some sense of it, but his point here is, before they had ever done anything good or bad, God chose. God made a choice.
Because he could see what they would do.
He could see. I'm not prepared to say that's why he made that decision. I don't know that. Maybe. Okay.
Well, he looked on the heart of David and saw that he was the man that he wanted. David said, he knew me before I was even born. I was the man that was born.
Yeah.
He knew.
But Sam, but God, over and over again, deliberately chooses in a manner to contradict man's logic.
That's right.
He chooses Gideon. His plans are unfold in a manner deliberately chosen to contradict man's logic.
Yeah, and all of this, what it does, one of the things it does is it shows us that God knows what God is doing, doesn't he? And he's not limited by my reason. And he's not obligated to make it make sense to me. And by the way, that's where we're going. That's where Paul's going to go. He's going to ask some questions. You read the article in the bulletin. He's going to ask some questions. He's not going to give you a satisfactory answer. You're going to want more, and you're going to try to figure out more and more. But he's going to ultimately say the answer to this is what? You are clay. He is the potter. You don't even have a right to call him on the carpet and ask him why he made you this way or why he made somebody else. And Job, in essence, Job was on the right side, right? I mean, Job had a good point, but he kept insisting to God, and since you brought that up, I'll use that as a good illustration, thank you, that he said, God, I know you're more powerful than I am, and you're smarter than I am, and you're everything else in all the world more than I am, but I tell you one thing, I know that if you and I were to get in a debate, you could eat me alive. But if you would put, and the King James uses the word daisy, and it is a referee. If you would put a referee between me and you, I could prove you were wrong. But I'm going to have somebody to hold you off of me while I make my argument. But I can tell you one thing. My argument is good enough that I could prove that you're wrong in what's happening to me. Now, we tend to feel that way sometimes, don't we? And we do try. I'm not knocking trying to make this something that I can understand. Maybe I am knocking it just a little bit, because Paul knocked it when he's going to say, here's the question, is God unjust? That's not even a question, he said, that you have the right to call God to have to prove to you. God doesn't have to prove it to you. And that's where we're going with this. Now, let's don't stop right there. What was God's basis for choosing? And we'll have to end it right here pretty quickly. What was God's basis for choosing? Look at verse 14. What shall we say then? Is God unjust? Not at all. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I'll have compassion on whom I will have compassion. It does not therefore depend on man's desire or man's effort, but on what? God's mercy. What is the basis that God used to make the choice? Mercy. That's his basis. We don't particularly like that unless we're the recipients, the ones that get the mercy. Mercy, by its very nature, says, I don't have to have a reason that satisfies me. Mercy is free. Mercy is a gift. And so it doesn't have to make sense to you that God had the right. Let me give you an illustration real quickly. Janice and I, back several years ago, I was making trips to Belarus. I ran across a kid. I've told you this story before. I ran across this kid. He was about probably 10 years old when I first met him. And he just really attached himself to my heart. He followed me around everywhere I went. He came to all the Bible classes I taught. As a little kid, he took notes of every class that I was in. I don't know how his folks let him out of school, but they let him out of school. And every class that I taught, every time I preached there, He took notes of everything, and if he missed a single verse in everything that I said, he would patiently wait until everybody was gone after it was over, and he would come up to me, and he spoke English, and he would ask me, he said, right here, I missed that verse, or I'm not sure I got the right verse. And over a period of years in my traveling back and forth, he had a stack of notebooks of my lessons like this. Well, I got pretty attached to this kid, okay? I kind of like that, you know. Sorry about that, but I kind of like that. And over the years, there have been lots of parents who have come to me and tried to get me to help them get their kid to America for an education, and I never would consider it. I considered, not only did I consider this one, I'm the instigator. He was an orphan. I went to his uncle and his grandmother, and I proposed to them that Janice and I be allowed to bring him over here. If we could manage that, would they like the idea of him coming over here and being educated and going to college over here? Well, of course they like it, and of course he liked it. So we brought him over here. He had, in that same household, two brothers and a sister. Question. Because I brought him over here, was I obligated to bring any one of them over here? Did they like it that I chose him to be the one that I brought over here as opposed to them? Maybe, maybe not. So what? I didn't have an obligation to bring all of them over here because I brought him. Now you let that sit and soak for a little while.